When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hello and a very warm and especially warm welcome to this lockdown episode of On the Continent. I'm Luke Moore.
I'm Andy Brassel.
Andy, how the devil are you, chap? I know you've been a bit under the weather, so I thought I'd just check in with you before we get into the meat and drink of the show. Are you feeling better?
Yeah, onwards and upwards, Lukey. Of course, I was revitalised by the company of the renewed Jules Breach on Tuesday on Football Ramble Daily, which definitely helped, but plenty of interesting stuff to chew through today.
Absolutely. And if, you know, we shouldn't really be talking about things being infectious, but the only thing more infectious than coronavirus is the Jules Breach enthusiasm, which we welcome. And it's good to see her back on her feet as well. And pleased to hear you're feeling a bit better too. You sound a lot better. So good stuff. All right. Unfortunately, we have to start with some sad news this week. Former Marseille president Papa Diouf has sadly passed away from coronavirus. I mean, it was only a week or two ago we were talking about ex-Real Madrid president Lorenzo Sanz sadly suffering the same fate. But plenty of our listeners, and I include myself in this, wouldn't have been overly familiar with the Papa Diouf story. He was listed in the obituaries as ex-Marseille president. But the story he had to come from where he came from to reach where he eventually reached is actually quite a remarkable one, Andy. And I wonder if you can give us a quick potted history of his life and what he was able to achieve and how he did it.
Yeah, well, he's born in Chad to a Senegalese family, and he grew up in Senegal, came over to France as a teenager, which was always the plan because his dad was very French loyalist. And what he didn't imagine, I think, is that his son, who studied political science at Aix-en-Provence, would go on afterwards to become a journalist. When he was at the university at Aix-en-Provence, he worked as a postman as well. And he worked with a guy called Tony Salvatore as well, who invited him to contribute to the football section because he knew he was a massive football fan, of a newspaper called Le Marseillaise, which was actually a communist newspaper. And that was the point at which Pap Diouf started to become a journalist. Now, his dad never lived long enough to see him start producing his own articles and get his own bylines in, but his mum did, which was a huge sense of pride for him. Now, later on, he ended up working for a daily paper called Le Sport, which was conceived as a sort of rival to L'Équipe. Now, it didn't last very long at all, but it really worked for him in the sense that because he was working for a newspaper profile, and because by this point he'd been working around Olympique de Marseille for a while, it meant that he was familiar with a lot of the players. He had a lot of good relationships with them, and actually it was one of his mates, Joseph Antoine Bell, who you might remember as being the Cameroonian goalkeeper. He was Marseille's goalkeeper as well, and him and Diouf were mates, and it was actually Joseph Antoine Bell who suggested to him, look, come on, you're personable, you're approachable, you're knowledgeable, why don't you become an agent? And that was when he started to become an agent. Now, people really liked him anyway, because he was diligent, he was forthright, he always asked questions of Bernard Tapie when he was the president of Marseille, and that was definitely not a given in those days, but he wasn't scared of him at all, and he got respect from Tapie because of that, because he asked him questions that he felt, I think sometimes Tapie felt that Diouf didn't like him, but Diouf always insisted, no, it's just my job to actually ask questions of you. And so that sort of established him really as a man of standing. Now, it was interesting how the relationship with Joseph Antoine Bell had developed, because people would struggle to get hold of Bell when he was traveling about. They would often ring Pap Diouf's house, because there weren't mobile phones at the time, and leave a message there. And that's what said to Bell, well, you know, maybe this is something that he could do. And, you know, you look at the sort of players that Diouf picked up, it showed how trustworthy he was as a bloke. You know, he had Basil Boli, Marcel Desailly, the late Marc Vivien Foe was one of his clients. Abide Pelé, the great Abide Pelé, was one of his clients. Freddie Canuto. You get further down the line, he was Samir Nasri's first agent. He was Didier Drogba's agent. But it wasn't all black African guys or guys from black African families. He had a Gregory Coupe, Sylvain Armand, who was great for Nantes and Paris Saint-Germain. So he was someone who the community of footballers responded to really, really well. And this was what made him such a successful agent. The other thing that made him such a successful agent, he never signed a contract in his life. He was very clear from day one that he said to Joseph Antoine Bell, look, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it with a handshake. Because, and his mate, Joseph Antoine Bell, said to him, you know, that's really the best way of doing it, because that's what makes you stand apart. Because the reason he said to him, you should become an agent, is not just because of your existing relationship with guys, but he said, people have a certain view of agents, and they certainly had a certain view of agents back then in the 90s. And he said, you can do it differently. I know you can do it differently. And he did do it differently.
Yeah, amazing story. I mean, so it's just some of the players you've listed there, and there's plenty that you haven't as well. It's a bit of a who's who of French football, really. And then, he uses his contacts and his experience working with all these players and getting close to the club, to Marseille, and ends up becoming president, the first black African president in French football, I believe. And overseas... Yes. Quite an interesting period of time for them as well, and not long after he's moved on, they experienced some success that he undoubtedly laid the foundation stones for, right?
Well, he did, absolutely, Luke. I mean, he signed Didier Deschamps just before he was removed as president of Marseille, and in his first season, Didier Deschamps won the title back for Marseille, and the last time they'd won the title, he was a player. So it was nearly 20 years before that. It was what, 18 years before that, if you're not counting the title that was withdrawn from them in 1993 after the Jacques Glassman scandal. But I think when you look at the spell in charge of Marseille, of Pap Diouf, I think it's easy to look at it just in terms of the players. And to an extent, I'm not against that because, I mean, they went through in L'Equipe, I think, a best 11 of the Diouf years. And, I mean, he signed Steve Mandanda, for example, who was really thought as just a jobbing goalkeeper up until that point, and he set him on the way to being a superstar. The 11 they had, it had Abby Bay in it, Nasri, who we mentioned before, Franck Ribéry, Djibril Cissé, Mamadou Niang. It had loads of absolutely terrific players who became part of Marseille under him. Of course, they didn't quite get there in terms of trophies, although especially when Eric Gerets was coach, it was an immensely exciting time.
It was a time when Lyon were dominating Ligue 1, though, wasn't it? Yeah,
and he made them a threat again, and they came within 3 points of the title 1 year. But really, I think what has caused this huge outpouring of grief, both on social channels, of course, because we're all indoors at the moment, and because Marseille fans are among the most active, certainly in a French football context at the moment. But also, we've seen banners around major buildings and thoroughfares and bridges in Marseille saying, rest in peace, Pape Diouf, and all that sort of stuff. Because even when he went, the fans really felt he was one of them. There were not many presidents, even presidents like Robert Louis-Dreyfus, who was formerly part owner of Adidas, of course. And
one of the best names for a president in world football as well.
Yeah, it's magnificent. Yeah,
Robert Louis-Dreyfus is brilliant. It sounds like a combination of like Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Feels like it's going to say Robert Duval at some point. It's just an amazing name. Did his reputation live up to his name?
Well, he poured so much money into Marseille, of course. Whereas Diouf wasn't a guy who was a massive benefactor. He was someone who was brought in as general manager and then was made president because of his skill with people. But as I said, this outpouring of grief in the city of Marseille after his death just goes to show that they really felt he was one of them. And a lot of the banners have said that quite explicitly. And I think you have to understand the context of Marseille, not just as a football club, but as a city within France. I think you can compare it maybe to Naples in Italy, or maybe even to Liverpool here in England, because the people sometimes feel a bit apart. They sometimes feel as if they're looked down upon, discriminated a bit against by an unfairly pilloried by other people in the country. And Pape Diouf, unlike most presidents, wasn't really bothered about his P's and Q's. And because he loved the city, because he arrived as a teenager, because from the moment he arrived in the city, he went to see Marseille every week. So before he was a journalist and after he was a journalist, he kept going to see them. Even when he moved back to Dakar, he kept on a little two-bedroom flat in the city so he could hop over and see them every so often. I think the last time he went to see them was back end of last season when they played Nantes. And when he took his taxi, he had to drop him off in a little park just next door to the Velodrome. And he had to walk about 150 yards up to the stadium. And it took him like 45, 50 minutes to do it because he was just getting mobbed the whole way. People,
it's like you walking around Wimbledon, mate.
Yeah.
It's like you going to the new Plough Lane in August.
Yeah, that's pretty comparable.
But the thing is, it is a genuinely remarkable story when you put it like that. Because and you're absolutely right, I think, to bring up the profile and the soul and the spirit of Marseille as a city itself, because it clearly is proud of being able to produce these kind of stories, excuse me, and for a kid to come as a teenager to start watching Marseille and to essentially build his life there and achieve what he was able to achieve is really an incredible, almost Hollywood type story. Do you think he could he have risen? It's a difficult question to answer, but could he have risen the way he rose at Marseille anywhere else in France, do you think?
I don't know if he could have. And I think they found out pretty quickly what they got when they made him president, because, like I said, not only did people have the sense that they could deal with Marseille a little bit better because he was someone who was intensely relatable, and people are generally a little bit scared of Marseille because it's thought of as, you know, a volatile big city and a club that's a law unto itself. Now, I think at the same time, Diouf made them approachable, but also he stood up for what he saw as the values of the club and of the city. And if he felt that, as we were saying before, they're being discriminated against by the FFF or other clubs, he would come out and say it. He would say, you can't treat us like this. You know, we deserve to be treated as equals. And also, you look at the people he went toe-to-toe with. I mean, around the 2006 World Cup, you remember when Franck Ribéry really exploded after that brilliant season at Marseille. Yeah. And, you know, he became a vital player, didn't he? You remember that game against Spain he played where he really took off in the 2006 World Cup. And Lyon, who, as you were pointing out before, Luke, were preeminent around then, were trying to sign him. And Ribéry was trying to go as well. And,
unlike him.
Yeah, I know. Extraordinary.
What a surprise.
But, you know, you thought it felt, because Lyon were Lyon of the time, that it was inevitable. But Pape Diouf was absolutely not having it. And he just went toe-to-toe with Jean-Michel Aulas, the most powerful guy in French football at the time. And he said, look, you ain't going to mug us like this, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Get out. And yeah, he managed to keep him. And then he ended up selling him on to Bayern when he wanted to for, you know, a fair chunk of change, a little bit down the line, for a guy that they signed for nothing when his contract with Galatasaray fell apart, of course. So that was a huge profit to the club, something that Marseille have not been able to consistently do, really, make the most of their playing assets. Of course, there was also this other episode later in 2006 with Paris Saint-Germain, where they or more specifically, Diouf had this dispute with Paris, because at the time Paris Saint-Germain were having quite a lot of security issues around the Parc des Princes, and he felt that the away fans, the Marseille fans, had A, not been given a big enough allocation, and B, their security hadn't been guaranteed.
It's so fascinating about sending the reserves, right?
Yeah, they sent the reserve team, but the reserve team, which is made up of basically apprentices and amateurs on the whole. And so he sends them along as this incredible act of defiance for Le Classique, which is the biggest game in France, the Parc des Princes. And, you know, if they end up losing 2-0 or 3-0 and put up a good show, he's made his point, and, you know, fair enough. They get a 0-0 draw, yeah, and they celebrate on the pitch at the end as if they've won the World Cup. And it's just such an immense vindication for him. But it was the way as well that he got involved with supporters clubs. Just the little things. It's not just the grand gestures. You know, there was a story that came up in the last day or so about a lady whose husband was part of a supporters club in the north. And he was killed in a traffic accident on the way to a game where Marseille were playing at Le Havre, just down the road from where this guy lived. And Pape Diouf called her all the time, said, do you need anything? He turned up personally at the funeral. When supporters traveling Marseille supporters had problems at other places like Atletico Madrid when they're in Europe, he got stuck in, he got involved, and he made sure they were all right. He was someone who really, you know, felt and breathed the city and breathed the club, and he understood that everyone involved was important, not just other directors, not just star players, but everyone, all the people who came to the Velodrome were important to him.
And that's well said. And I really like this, just to finish off on Pape Diouf, I like this. There was an article written by Eric Devon in The Guardian today.
Yeah.
Where, and I like the way it finished, obviously, him talking about Duffy said, his death is one of many in the world at the moment, but for a man whom race, class or social standing were no obstacle and for whom no opponent seemed too big, it is only fitting that we note the passing of Pap Diouf by honouring him for what he was, a principled, fearless and forthright individual whose ambitions and influence on the game knew no limit. Nice fitting end to that obituary to him by Eric Devlin in The Guardian there. Yeah, I mean, all the best and condolences to his family and his friends at what is a really difficult time.
Sur un Marseillais, les Stéphanois complètement perdus par ce premier but encaissé et surtout déboussolés par la blessure de Perrin, viennent de perdre très très gros sur deux occasions marseillaises.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Okay, Andy, next, I thought we'd speak about one of the big stories of this football age while there's no football actually happening. We joked, didn't we, a week or two ago that we'd end up turning this show into a soap opera talking about gossiping owners and people sending broadsides to each other trying to score political points while there's no football to be concerned with. And this issue that appears to be rearing its head now is not just the one of when football will return, because that's clearly a bit far away on the horizon. It's about finances. It's about player wages. It's about how you get to the situation where football clubs can still tolerate these regular heavy outgoings with no income on match days at the moment. And as we'll find out in just a moment, no broadcasted revenue either. Now, we've seen people listening who are based in the UK will have seen that a few clubs in the Premier League have started to take advantage of the government's furloughing scheme, which has caused a bit of controversy for a number of different reasons we perhaps won't get into on this show, because we like to focus on European football. But while two European giants have made some steps themselves, lots has been made about Barcelona, who Leo Messi again used it as a great opportunity to have a side swipe at the decision makers at the club, saying they put pressure on the players to do something we were always going to do anyway. talking about Barcelona and his players taking a huge pay cut. And there's been an interesting situation in Juventus as well. Giorgio Chiellini, it's been reported, has been at the forefront of negotiating salary deferments for Juve players, totaling around 90 million euros. It's expected the players will probably claw around half of that back post the summer, all being well. I mean, worth remembering that Chiellini himself is out of contract in June and hasn't played much this season due to an ACL injury, although he is expected to sign an extension. What do you make of this, Andy? What do you make of the way these big clubs are starting to come out of the woodwork and start to make plans for how they deal with this financial fallout?
Well, I think it's very, very important when it comes to Barcelona, certainly, because they run at such monstrous overheads. They needed to do something.
A 70% cut is huge, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And we have to say it's not just a 70% cut. It's actually a 72% cut because the players are putting in an extra 2% each as well to cover the wages of everyone who works at the club to make sure they're paid in full during the time that the football's off. So I think the optics of it are very, very interesting. As you were saying, Messi is just so full of rage, belatedly, I would say, with the way the club has run. You know, there's a lot of people out there have been worried that the club has been wasting his peak for the best part of 5 or 6 years. And in the last year or so, he's just become so angry with them that if they a member of the board at Barcelona presented Messi with a brand new 500 euro note, he'd probably look at it, check the other side and say, well, it's a bit curly at the edges, isn't it? You know, it's just so, I think, dubious of their motives now. And he's certainly dubious of the way they present stuff in a PR sense. I mean, they had arguments over how Abidal talked about the sacking of Valverde and the appointment of Setién and
Andy, just to cut on that. Just to cut in very quickly because I'm interested in this. What is the relationship? Because I know Eric Abidal is one of the decision makers at the club at Barcelona now. What is the relationship between Lionel Messi, who is of course an ex teammate of his, and Eric Abidal? Because Abidal,
it was great.
Right, is he soured because he had an amazing story and everyone seemed to rally around him and he was really popular? But is he put himself in a position now where the relationship between him and some, maybe even some of the other players is completely broken down?
Yeah, it's totally untenable. And I think it says a lot about where Barcelona are that no real conclusion has been reached on this matter. I mean, it seemed inevitable at the time that either Abidal had to climb down or leave. Probably leave, and it's just reached this weird impasse. But to say that Abidal's the only problem that Messi has with the Barcelona board would not be correct. At the same time, I think it's a succession of straws breaking the camel's back, really. And maybe Messi's having one of these moments of clarity, like, God, what have I put up with for all these years? You know, maybe he was just too busy getting on with his job to really think about it before, while other people around him were saying, you know, why are you putting up with this shit? I think, you know, his sense has always just been to get on with the football. But maybe now he's a little bit further down the line. And maybe now, especially now with what's happening at the moment, I think he already had a sense of his footballing mortality. And now that's probably accentuated a little bit with the current situation. But yeah, the fact that they've come to verbal public blows, the two sides, and it's clear whose side the players are on, clearly. You know, what was such an open and shut deal has become another public argument is extraordinary to me. Juventus's needs are somewhat different, of course, because as you said, the fact that they're not going to be paid the players for March, April, May, June as things stand, and yes, they may get some of that back further down the line depending on if and when football resumes in Italy. And I have to say, certainly the way things are at the moment, that is by no means a foregone conclusion. Because in large parts of Italian football, Italian society, and Italian fandom, actually. You had an ultra group from Atalanta saying, you know what, just write the season off because our city has lost too much on a human level. And I think we can overlook that sometimes because, of course, we're so anxious, many of us, to give us something to look forward to, especially in these times that we want football to restart. I think it's difficult to put yourselves in the shoes of the Italians and what they've actually been through on a human level. And of course, there will be some people who want it to restart and you know, bring back some joy to the country and all that sort of stuff. It's, you know, a very you know, it's a very obvious thing to say, isn't it? On the other hand, I think this to me felt like something quite significant. The idea that a supporters group and an ultras group would say that, okay, from a sporting perspective, we stand to lose quite a lot because we're having our greatest ever season on the pitch. We got to the quarterfinals of the Champions League. We're in the top four and we're likely to stay there. And, you know, as we've discussed on many occasions, Luke, you know, Atalanta are a genuine member of the top clubs of Italy now, certainly above Milan and on current form above Napoli and Roma as well. But for a group of hardcore supporters to say, you know what, we actually don't give a shit about this. This isn't important in the general flow of life at the moment.
Yeah, the reason it's powerful,
quite a big moment.
Yeah, the reason it's powerful is because it completely blows out of the water the idea of any kind of self-interest being at the forefront of an opinion.
Exactly. So, that's why it stands out, isn't it?
Exactly. If you look at the opinions of pretty much, not everyone, but most people, whether they've been briefing off the record to people like our friend David Ornstein, or whether they've been publicly saying what they've been saying, and I'm talking about based in this country, it has been met with a howls of and accusations of self-interest, and that's probably to be expected, particularly when it initially starts, and then when the dust starts to settle and there'll be a few twists and turns along the way before we settle on what is a solution that's not going to be happy for everyone. I mean, there is no solution to this that makes everyone happy. And I think people need to make their peace with that. But for the Atalanta supporters group to say that, I think is a very, very powerful thing to say. And what it does is it throws into pretty stark focus how badly that part of Italy has been affected by this virus. But one thing that this, whether it be about the return of football or whether it be about the deferral or cut of wages among players and how clubs approach that, what it's actually made quite clear to me is something I've felt for a wee while now, is that the leadership shown at the top of the game is very, very lacking. I mean, what makes me uncomfortable, and we talked about this in a slightly different context in the past, and we talked about it in the context of players being racially abused while they're trying to play football. And to me, it feels like it shouldn't be incumbent upon the players to show the leadership here. I feel like at the top of the game, there are decision makers, whether they be FIFA, UEFA, the relevant leagues or whatever. There are decision makers who should be making these decisions, because it can't be done in a piecemeal way by groups of players or individual clubs, whatever the issue. If it's a big issue that crosses that threshold where it affects everything in the game, it needs to be done and needs to be made with the proper advice taken, of course, by the relevant stakeholders, but it needs to be made by the associations. They need to show the leadership on it. There was a really interesting piece yesterday about Daniel Levy and his taking advantage of the government's furloughing scheme, which created a lot of criticism. And someone said, look, is he actually just trying to force a debate about this, a solution to this that is taken across the board by all the football clubs in the Premier League, for example?
That's very charitable to him.
Well, I think it probably comes from a place of trying to defend him, and I don't necessarily agree with it. But what I'm saying is the principle is ultimately sound, which is you cannot confuse the fact that because players are the most high profile people in this industry, if it is a big issue that needs to be solved universally, it needs to be solved by the big decision makers at the top of the club, at top of the game. So, so that's why I don't really have an awful lot of sympathy with Lionel Messi on this particular issue in isolation. I know he's got his problems with Barcelona. I know they're probably pretty well founded. I know he's frustrated. But it isn't for him to say, oh, well, the players were going to do this anyway. Well, it's not really the players' decision, or it shouldn't be. It should be done with the agreement of the players, with the input of the players, but the decision should be taken by the association. In no other industry I can think of do individual people or individual high-profile people in that industry have to be the ones who make these decisions. And the reason it's relevant to something like racism is, oh, well, the players who just walk off the pitch. Fine, I've got no problem with that, really. But it shouldn't have got to that stage, and it shouldn't be incumbent upon them to have to make those decisions. Do you understand what I mean?
I do understand what you mean, but I think, whereas in principle, that's a very sound way of looking at it, the reality is that in many cases, players and their brands are more influential than the clubs themselves nowadays. So for them
you could argue that's been allowed to happen because the associations themselves haven't got grip on the whole thing anyway.
Yeah, you could in this particular instance. But what you could also argue is that because the players in many cases are bigger than the clubs, certainly in terms of brand projection, them coming out and saying something is more effective in a public and civic way. So in that sense, I'm not really against it. Going back to the Juventus thing, I'm really interested to get into this because, yeah, I think, like you, I believe Chiellini will stay, and I think it will make a lot of sense. And certainly in a week where we've seen this renewed speculation around the future of Matthijs de Ligt, then I would be very, very surprised if Juventus were to sell him, and despite the fact he's had not an ideal start to his career, a season of him playing alongside Chiellini could be worth so much to Juventus. And I think that has been the main thing that has been missing from De Ligt's adaptation to Serie A so far. I think it's something that could really help him and really help them going forward. The other thing is we've seen reports in Italy this week saying maybe Juventus could be forced to sell Cristiano Ronaldo, even with this 90 million, it's maybe not a 90 million saving overall, but at least deferral for the moment of these wages. Because, you know, the minute they signed Cristiano Ronaldo, it changed the model and direction of Juventus, because it's such a huge financial pressure on them, not just in terms of fee and signing on fee, but obviously these enormous wages as well. It's said that we're all in for the Champions League right now, which hasn't happened for the moment. Of course, that doesn't mean it won't happen, maybe even in the near future, depending on how this Champions League season finishes. But there were suggestions in one of these articles from Italy about how this might be brought to a conclusion, that either Juventus would sell Cristiano Ronaldo, that they would reduce his wages on a permanent basis, or just simply not extend his contract, which is up in 2 years. But I think whether this is true or not, I think it's a strong recognition of the fact that, you know, he is a financial pressure on them that, you know, they've never had before, and they'll probably never have again, to be perfectly honest, because signing a player for that amount of money well into his 30s, we know he's an exceptional case. It's still something really huge for the club to have to deal with, and it changes the way that they do things. It put a lot of pressure on them last summer when they needed to sell more players and they weren't able to do that. And this squad, there's no way they can keep together all the elements going forward. The fact that they've got, they're on the hook for not just Cristiano Ronaldo's money, but Dybala's money, Higuain's money, and all the other players in the squad. They can't keep this squad together going forward. And, you know, I think for them to at least consider or explore the possibility of doing something about their financial obligations to Cristiano Ronaldo is it's far from unreasonable.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting point. And I think what it also throws up is the idea that this whole thing is going to change football in a huge number of ways.
Exactly.
Just quickly, to throw further weight behind your point, Rui Chiellini and De Ligt. I think Chiellini got injured around September time, didn't he? And De Ligt signed in the summer. So I think it's been quite overlooked how important that would have been. I mean, I dare say it might have even been a factor into why De Ligt signed for Juventus, that he might have been able to play alongside and learn from, you know, a 35-year-old veteran of some standing who's clearly of such good quality and experience. And he's not been able really to do that much at all. Yeah,
now, mate, if you're saying like that Bonucci is a selfish partner in a way that Chiellini isn't, you go ahead and say that. I'm not going to stop you. I'm
a
not
selfish lover.
Yeah. Chiellini's a generous lover.
But on the Cristiano thing, and really, Cristiano is in many ways is an extreme example of football's excesses. Generally, isn't he? And I was really interested actually in what Simon Jordan was saying, the ex-Crystal Palace owner, on the radio last week. I think he's an excellent pundit, particularly on this kind of issue around football, finances and organisation and administration and stuff. And he was actually saying that the way football deals with this issue, the way players deal with their wages, the way the clubs handle the finances, the way the broadcasters do what they're going to do, is probably a bit of a fork in the road for football generally. And people need to understand, I hope I'm not putting words in his mouth or paraphrasing him, but what I took from it was that he was saying that people need to understand that the decisions that are made now in football will probably ring throughout the next 20, 30, 40 years in terms of the direction the sport takes. And it's been clear for a while that football's been moving away from being this relatable thing. I think it was, I interviewed Ben Turner from Sunderland Till I Die yesterday, and he was saying that, you know, football is a working class game that's now loved by the middle classes, but it used to just be this relatable thing. And these players are used to live among, for want of a better phrase, everyday people. And it's not been that for a while. And football could do a great job here of repairing its reputation in this way with the communities that it purports to represent based on this crisis. And I wonder whether that it might get to the point where they don't have a choice. And the reason I say that is because at the start of this particular section, I alluded to the idea that broadcasters might have a role to play in this. And the reason I said that is because the two main broadcasters in France, the French equivalent of Sky Sports and BT, have said, as things stand, we can't imagine football happening anytime soon, so we're not going to pay you the latest portion of the revenue you're due. And that could have absolutely seismic consequences if that's repeated throughout Europe, couldn't it?
Yeah, it could. And do you know what? I don't think it's completely beyond the realms of possibility, because I think we all know, and anyone who takes an even slight interest in broadcasting rights knows, that broadcasters have been overpaying for football for a very long time in a quite unsustainable way. I mean, I remember someone from a major European football broadcaster saying to me that their channel, not that long ago actually, that their channel couldn't afford to have the rights, but couldn't afford not to have the rights as well. And I kind of understand where they're coming from there. And, you know, you look at the situation, as you say, in France with Canal Plus and now beIN Sports, who've followed suit and said, look, basically, we're not going to front up the last payment. The thing is that it's not just a principled stand. It is a bit Weatherspoons as well, because in some cases, they're not paying for some matches that they've shown already. I mean, that's certainly the case with beIN. Like, some of the money corresponds to 15 live games that they've already shown.
That's wrong. They shouldn't be doing that. They should be doing it the principled way, and they should be paying for the stuff they've already shown. I completely understand and sympathise with the idea that, look, we're not going to pay for a product we're not going to receive, and that can be sorted out by whatever the terms of the contract are. But if you've already shown some of the games, you've got to really be paying for that.
Exactly. And the other thing as well we have to take with the Canal Plus side of it, and Canal Plus has been like Sky, as you were saying, the main broadcaster of French football for well over 20 years now. And like Sky, their whole brand is based on being the football channel. And they're also now, once again, the holder of the Premier League rights. Now, I believe this was why John Cross brought it up in the Mirror this week, because his view was not just on the fact that broadcasters all over the continent were looking at to each other to see who was doing what and who was in terms of their obligations and all that sort of stuff. I think John was also looking at the fact that how foreign rights holders and whether they would withhold money would affect the Premier League, because of course that's worth several billion pounds to the Premier League across all those deals. The thing with Canal, as we say, is a huge part of their personality being the rights holder for the main chunk of the football. That's not going to be the case from next season. So I am slightly cynical about this. When you got to the point where Canal are right, we're going to withhold the rest of the money. In most other situations, you'd say, well, you know, there's going to be some sort of middle ground here because, you know, they need a future relationship with the league. But Canal don't. You know, they already feel as if the league's totally sold them out, basically, in selling the rights to a Spanish media company, in fact, who still have to form their own channel and work out the way that they're going to diffuse it from next season. I mean, I know there are a load of super complicated things that we're trying to work through about what will happen when next season, if next season happens, when it eventually start, all that sort of stuff. Even if it had been a completely normal situation, things were very, very up in the air in terms of French TV rights. But in the short term, the league has got a massive problem because on average, 47% of clubs' income, not including transfers, is from TV. And then you bear in mind what they're not getting from match days. And, of course, the fact that if you take away some of the biggest clubs, like not just Paris Saint-Germain, but to an extent Lyon, Marseille, teams like that, that TV money will represent an even bigger chunk of what they get. So it's moving to a point. We've been worried, and quite rightly, about lower division clubs in this country and in other countries across Europe. This could mean that we're edging towards a problem where the majority of clubs in European football, and not just at low in a low division level, are in big financial trouble.
All right, let's end with a bit of old-fashioned beef. Let's do that.
Bring the beef. Come on.
Yeah, bring on the beef. We did joke, as I said at the start of the show, we did joke that this show would just descend into what someone said about someone else. And we were talking about presidents. But now we're going to turn our attention to talking about players. Karim Benzema has referred to himself as a Formula One car, called Olivier Giroud a go-kart. Olivier Giroud has responded by calling himself a World Cup winning go-kart, which is very nice. And for those who don't remember, Benzema was left out of the World Cup squad in 2018. He hasn't played for France since 2015 after manager Didier Deschamps dropped him due to a formal investigation into a sex tape blackmail plot, if you remember that weird news. What's the origin of this beef between the two players specifically, Andy? I know Karim Benzema's got a rap sheet as long as anyone's arm, but what's the origin of the beef between these two? Because I instinctively always fall down the side of Olivier Giroud, who I absolutely love for a number of different reasons, but am I fair and right to do so?
Well, what I would say is, if you're going to be offended by anything that Karim Benzema's done, and this was in the course of a pro-celebrity Instagram live questioning last Sunday.
Better and better, classier and classier.
Yeah, I don't think Benzema has correctly respected the parameters of Instagram Live questioning. Firstly, he wasn't wearing his club tracksuit like Serge Aurier. secondly, he didn't have a shisha on the go. There were no slurs against his own teammates, because he did play with Olivier Giroud once, but that was quite a long time ago, and I think he's actually scrubbed it from his mind because he finds it such a traumatic thing. You know what? Benzema, for someone who sees himself as a man of the people, and he's a player I love and enormously respect, and, you know, I saw his first big season with Lyon at first hand when I lived there back in 2007, 2008. And, you know, it was one of the most exciting seasons of a player that I've ever seen at first hand. He was absolutely magnificent. But what I think is amazing is that, you know, in the intervening like 13, 14, 15 years, so much has changed, and yet so little has changed. You know, he's someone who's international in his 30s. He's got a glittering career behind him, but he's just behaving like a brat here. And
yeah,
the thing is, I think he sees himself as the real. You know, he sees himself as this guy. He's from the hood. He's not forgotten where he's from, and all this sort of stuff. And Giroud's not like him because, you know, he's not as talented, for one. And I think that is the big thing. And there is a snobbery in terms of technical quality.
Yeah, because Karim Benzema also went on to say something along the lines of, we know what Giroud brings, or we know the kind of football he likes to play, and do people like that? I'm not so sure. Something like that, wasn't it? It was that kind of dig at the way he plays the game,
yeah,
as well.
It's a very reductive way of viewing what Olivier Giroud brings to the table. But I think it's more than that. I think it's a sense that, oh, well, you know, Olivier Giroud's just traditional France. He's a bit posh. He's a qualified sommelier and all the rest of it. Whereas,
hang on, is he actually a qualified sommelier?
Yeah, he is. Yeah,
oh, that's amazing. I didn't know that.
You see, the thing is, I think it's the wrong way around of looking at it. Because if I was Giroud, and he's far too nice to say it, of course, I'd be thinking, well, you're a spoilt little academy brat who was always the family's little prince and always looked after on your way up through this like posh academy. Whereas, you know, the preeminent academy in France and one of them in Europe. Whereas me, I actually had to go and do a bloody proper job and work hard to get into professional football. And, you know, bear in mind, at the time when Karim Benzema had already scored against Manchester United in the Champions League, won a couple of Ligue 1 titles, signed his deal for Real Madrid, and become a big star there. At that point, Giroud was still trying to make it. He hadn't even made it in the top flight. You know, he was slogging away at Grenoble, and it didn't look like he was going to get anywhere. It didn't even look as if he was going to like play a top flight game, let alone make it as an elite level footballer. So this sort of inverse snobbery that Benzema's got against him, not just on a technical level, and that is something that is not just Benzema. I think it's France and French football, and a lot of French football supporters have had a lot of this snobbery about Giroud for quite a long time. I think that has changed a little bit post-World Cup, because people saw the selfless job that he did. You know, people have never mentioned his name in the same sentence as Stefan Kivac, who, by the way, did his bet in 98, but not to the same extent as Olivier
Giroud.
And
it was a bit, by the way. I mean, you're right to say it was a bit.
He
didn't score any goals, did he? Did he score one? I can't remember how many he scored. But he scored any.
You know what? It is about public projection as well. And where I think Giroud has had belated respect is from the fact that he's so publicly endorsed by Antoine Griezmann. And funnily enough, I think Benzema, if he really thought about it, could appreciate that, because he's benefited so much from the endorsement of Cristiano Ronaldo.
Yeah.
Loads of people have always thought that 100%. Benzema's not good enough for Real Madrid, that he's not a genuine world-class striker. Now, of course, he could turn around and say, well, look, I'm the top scoring Frenchman in the history of the Champions League. I've won a load of swag since I've been here, including for Champions Leagues. But, you know, if people want to be deaf to that, they're going to be deaf to that. But he's doing exactly the same thing. I think, on the other hand, this sort of slight review of what Giroud is worth in French footballing society is to do with the fact that Griezmann has, like Ronaldo did with Benzema, or like Eden Hazard did with Giroud when he was playing for Chelsea, he's gone to him, you're my guy. I need you. I need you to be my best for France. And I think that has really worked well for Olivier Giroud. But Giroud has played this smartly. Maybe he's played it completely consistently with his personality. I don't know, but because I don't know him that well personally. But I think the fact that he has just not said anything, I think is the best possible way he can deal with this. Because if he rolls around in the mud, all he's going to do is get dirty. And he is the World Cup winner. He is the person with, regardless of talent, the better international goal scoring record. He's going to end up with more caps than him as well. All that sort of stuff. I mean, he's won the battle, if indeed it is a battle. Now, Benzema could have been one of the greats for France, but for reasons, and reasons that he would say are not entirely his fault, and I do have some sympathy for that point of view, he's someone who has not fulfilled his potential as a
absolutely
farmer.
And I think, you know, speaking of being sympathetic to Benzema's point of view, I don't know as much about the situation as you, and I'll concede that, but on a very basic level, I don't know if I do have any sympathy with Benzema. The situation that arose in 2015, and let's not forget, you know, these controversies are things that have dogged Benzema pretty much his entire career, and the situation that arose in 2015, where he ended up no longer being picked for France, is because Deschamps thought that we could get on by without him. Yes, he's a talented player. Yes, he plays at a top club. Yes, as you rightly say, Andy, he's won a lot of things, but we feel like we can get by without him. Now, that is the manager's choice. The manager lives and dies by that decision. But what happened? Well, France went on and won the World Cup. So that's been vindicated. Mm. Ultimately, I don't particularly have too much sympathy with players who kind of feel like, oh, the game owes me this, the game owes me that. And through decisions, through no fault of my own, I've not been given what's owed to me, or I've not received this 100th France cap, or I've not been part of the World Cup winning squad. I don't think he wasn't even part of Euro 2016 either. The reason that's happened largely is down to the decisions he's made himself.
Yeah,
there are very, very few people who, and I would probably just include serious injuries in this, or serious kind of personal tragedies in this, that don't have power at that level over their own decision making and their own commitment to what they're doing. And Benzema, I'm afraid, gets very, very little truck from me with that kind of attitude, because he's been throughout his career, mate.
With Benzema, it's never been the talent; it's been the other stuff. That's the thing. But on the one hand, he's kind of built his image around the fact that I've never forgotten where I'm from, and, you know, I'm still this boy from the estates, which is fine. But then when the people who are around you get you into these situations, which is definitely what happened with the sex tape, you know, you've got to take the rough with the smooth if you're presenting yourself like that, haven't you?
Yeah, careful with that. I think you're absolutely right. Look, Andy, in a word, are you Team Giroud or Team Benzema?
Look, it's a great line from Benzema. It might be unfounded, unreasonable, unjustified, and I know you're going to be Team Giroud anyway. So I'll stick with Benz, I think.
All right, it's 1-1 then. All right, thank you very much indeed for that, Andy. Thanks for your company as ever on the continent. Always love it. Always learn a lot as well. Don't forget that you can check back with Football Ramble Daily tomorrow for the gang and Marcus, Jim, Pete and I for the previous show. There'll be a Blizzard show on Saturday. That's all we've got time for here on the continent. But do, if you're looking for other stuff to listen to, do go and check out our Patreon. patreon.com/footballrambledaily. There's a patron only shop there at the moment, which is an interview by me with Ben Turner, one of the creators of Sunderland Till I Die, that fantastic Netflix documentary series, which season two of has just dropped, and season one's available for catch up. It's a fascinating interview. He's a big Sunderland fan. He talks about the labor of love that making Sunderland Till I Die was for him. You can get hold of that if you're a Patreon subscriber. You can also listen to loads of extra stuff, including behind the scenes audio, extra mailbag shows with Andy. There's a Discord there to chat on as well. Go and check it out if you get a moment. And let's face it, no one else is doing anything at all apart from listening to podcasts at the moment and watching Netflix. There's no excuses. All right, Andy, thanks very much for your time. Thanks for your company. Look forward to speaking to you again soon. And we'll be back tomorrow with the preview show. Have a great rest of the day and go well.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.